Hello, I'm Claire Armistead. Before we hear this week's podcast, we just wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more information on building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. Wherever we live around the world, immigration is a subject that touches us all. This week we're taking a look at two books which give voice to those whose lives have been shaped by travel to the UK in their search for a new and hopefully better life. We're given a glimpse into the terrifying dark side of London by the foreign correspondent Ben Judah.
We could go this morning or tomorrow morning or any day of the week and stand outside the construction yards and the B&Qs and the Wickses in outer London, and you will see dozens, sometimes hundreds of workers just touting. And there's no in-work benefits. There's no minimum wage. The white vans will roll up and then the bidding will start. Who's going to work for the cheapest pay? And the lowest wage that I saw was one chicken and chips for a day's work.
Then we travel to a different city, Sheffield, with one of the UK's most exciting new novelists, Sunjeev Sahota.
Immigration's just always been in my life and in my family's life, so it felt quite normal that I might want to just tap into that frequency and see if there was a novel there.
But we start with Ben Judah, who has been crisscrossing London from Berkeley Square to Peckham Rye, from Ilford to White City, talking with cleaners and labourers, drug dealers, teachers, policemen and witch doctors, to assemble a group portrait of a world city in which 37% of the population were born abroad. When he met up with Richard Lee to explore this urban upheaval, they began, like so many new arrivals, at Victoria Coach Station, where he reads from the opening of his new book, This is London.
I have been coming to the coach station every morning now for weeks, counting the buses and pacing up to strangers, first dozens, then hundreds, recording what they say into my phone. Again, I'm hungover, I'm cold. Again, the freeze steams every pane, and the damp air kneads itself into my clothes. Wheels crash through dirty water as coaches, bleeping and reversing, unload Paris, Bucharest and Rome. Pigeons flutter and ventilators moan. Hard rain patters the vaulting glass over the grubby terminal like a baby's rattle. My hands sting red as I key rapid notes into my screen. This is what life is like, morning after morning, at our miserable Ellis Island, the point from which our society is changing. This cramped hall, lined with grimy old payphones, echoes with languages I cannot understand. Sinti, Turkish, maybe Swahili. Tiles shine with electric light. Now Eurolines empties. A Romanian woman in a grey shell suit pulls off her hood, smiles timidly, steps away from a stocky man, and flicks her long, glossy brown hair back and forth. An oily, unshaven boy in an all-black hoodie and puffer jacket drags a sports bag and stares blankly into the squiggling colours of the tube map. I am standing in the damp again, keying in what I can see, because I only trust what I can see. I was born in London, but I no longer recognise this city. I don't know if I love the new London or if it frightens me, a city where at least 55% of people are not ethnically British, nearly 40% were born abroad, and 5% are living illegally in the shadows. I have no idea who these new Londoners are, or even what their London really is. This is why I keep coming here. Paris bleeps in. Wheelie bags click-clack, tugged by French metrosexuals in drainpipe jeans, chirping and gossiping. They wipe the rain off their moisturised faces and brown horn-rimmed glasses. A tall, masculine girl with a sloth-like frame and a jean skirt pulls herself up to the tiled wall and leans on it for a moment, closing her eyes until a harried African cleaner in day glow, clutching a mop, accidentally thwacks her shoulder and apologises. But she hardly registers as my fingers quickly input her reactions, like that day glow is on an invisible man. Now Cologne bleeps in. Two Bulgarian toughs with lined faces and puffy eyes in matching sky blue ski jackets unload charcoal rucksacks packed with pneumatic drills. They both scowl as the belly of the coaches empty, as frumpy, squabbling Roma in forest green headscarves and long black skirts snipe at each other as they haul bin bags stuffed to bursting with torn blankets and mouldy duvets over the mirroring puddles. They are following a yawning man under a black leather cap clutching only a scratched violin case. Making sound recordings of the murmuring din, I lose count of the coaches. Every week, 2,000 migrants unload at Victoria Coach Station. This is where tens of thousands of migrants arrive every year, the equivalent of a whole city the size of Basildon or Bath. They are all part of the same thing, the New London.
Richard began by asking him what it was about the world of new arrivals that made him want to start writing the book.
That guy standing over there, who's maybe come from Romania or Poland, he could, his daughter could marry my son, or his granddaughter could marry my granddaughter. And it, I just wanted to write about their story of arrival now, so that we can already think about how it's already part of us.
These people arriving here now, what are they looking for? What are they expecting to find?
Lots of people in Eastern Europe, I think, are running away from something. It's very common to talk to people from Poland and Romania and Ukraine about how they're trying to escape sort of lives of drudgery. And they think that London offers a possibility of transformation, that you can come here and you can go from one job to another, you can go from being one class to another. And they dream of London as that point. And lots of these people around us are looking for a home. And their lives, just like our lives, I think are really shaped by this centrifugal force of the marketplace of property and housing in London that's endlessly sort of pushing them further and further out of the centre into the fringes. I think in the minds of people here, there is these images of kind of glinting financial towers and the excitement of that, but most of their lives are going to unfurl at the fringes of London, in these sort of fraying and decaying suburbs, often in tenements, in old sort of gabled or pebble dash houses, commuting in and out for hours and hours by night bus or by sort of hour-long tube rides, where they will see and work in that glittering centre, cleaning it, guarding it, building it, but never really being part of it.
So is this British dream that they're chasing? Is it just bullshit, as your Romanian interpreter suggests?
There are quite a lot of people in the Eastern European construction centre who become millionaires. For them, it's not bullshit. You know, one of the guys that I met and who tells his story in the book owns three or four properties, a really successful construction company. For him, it wasn't bullshit. For a lot of the people in the construction industry, earning just under or nowhere near minimum wage probably is.
You speak of people looking for a home. You speak of the kind of the bright lights of the city of London. There's this kind of malleable career, the idea that you can move from one job to the next and somehow make a life for yourself here. So is the government right to focus on in-work benefits as a kind of strong draw factor?
I worked on construction sites and I lived in a DOS house with Romanian builders embarking. I didn't meet anyone who was abusing the benefit system. I didn't meet people who told me they had a large interest in the benefit system. And I didn't meet anyone who said that they wouldn't have come or that they would change their life plans around this particular notion that Cameron is pushing. In fact, what I saw is people who are way more exploited than I realised. And we could go this morning or tomorrow morning or any day of the week and stand outside the construction yards and the B&Qs and the Wickses in outer London, and you will see dozens, sometimes hundreds of workers just touting. And there's no in-work benefits. There's no minimum wage. The white vans will roll up and then the bidding will start. Who's going to work for the cheapest pay? And the lowest wage that I saw was one chicken and chips for a day's work. And this is where the soldiers of the construction boom are coming from. And one of the saddest things about working in a construction site, not that far away actually, in Pimlico, was that at lunch, like, surrounded by all the sawdust and paint pots and ripped up cardboard, it's a bit of a property developer's convention, because they know exactly how much their work is worth. And they know exactly how much it adds, how much what is worth and what's not. And there, you do see on people's faces that sense and that stress that maybe they're not going to be able to make a home in London after all. You hear it first, and then come its lights, and with a tiny crackle of joy, the cleaners move into the rain. The bus is coming. The double-decker, it squeals, it whooshes, and it bleeps open, its windows steamed and white with nasty bright light. They clamber on and swipe, and it feels a little warmer, but there is nowhere to sit. The plastic aisle shining with the wet marks from boots are filled with hoodies and puffers, and the cleaners force themselves on between 100 others. 4:15. The bus is at its busiest now, with Ghanaian men coming in for the dirtiest, nastiest cleaning in the tube depots. These men, free workers on the upper deck, have already changed into the bright orange jumpsuit of the hidden classes. White music cables dangle out of their ears, running over the firmly tied knots of their scarves. London is so very cold. They call this spring here. These men are hunched slightly and bloodshot, looking out away from the bright, stinging downlighting of the night bus through the smudgy circles they have made through the window steam. And I wonder what their music is that can take them so far away. You can see it clearly now, how exhaustion is a very personal thing, how it takes us to our very edge. They are those who cover their faces and those who bury them in their bags, and a few who chatter and giggle strangely in Romanian, or is it Yoruba, as the Middle Eastern growl of the driver calls to move down, move down, move the fuck down the aisle. You can hear the roar of the engine and the screech splash through the puddles. I can hear everything but see nothing. The windows are so steamed. The only thing you can make out is the endless lines of those orange traffic lamps, one after the other, that give the night its colour, and those flashes in and out as the bus screeches to a halt, of green and red and bright deep light. I will not find a seat.
So most of the Londoners who come here, who arrive at Victoria Coach Station or from Heathrow, they arrive looking for the bright lights. They don't end up in the centre. They're much further away, and they need to travel in to do their work, or travel across London to find work.
And that means in 21st century London, to be poor is to be exhausted. It's to be permanently shattered from the struggle every day, of those huge commutes, of hard, hard work. We got this idea in our mind from the 19th century that to be poor is to be starving, but to be perpetually at your very edge from exhaustion and very little sleep and usually two jobs is pretty bad too.
The conditions that people are living in these places outside the centre of London, they're often sleeping 5, 10, 15 people to a house. What's it like living like that? Do you lose your ability to think, to feel?
Human beings are some of the most adaptable, durable creatures in the world. I found in this DOS house that I lived in Barking, sharing a bed in a room with builders, two people, the same sort of rubbish mattresses, people's dreams and desires actually came out a lot keener than they would in maybe softer environments. And there, kind of late at night, people really would share these stories of the home they were trying to build. Either it was going to be here, either it was going to be back in Romania. People were endlessly counting in their phones just how much they needed to save, just how much they had, how the exchange rate was working with them or against them. Some guys were taking pictures of a lot of the work or the lovely architectural fronts they were seeing in London. You're trying to think, I'm going to have this bit in my dream house. I like that kind of front door. These are the gables that I like. People were really holding on to these dreams very tightly. I was told again and again, this is cramped, this is uncomfortable, but this is work. And they see, even in those conditions, that their there is a path, you can break a little further out. And coming from this little known wreck of the Romanian and the Polish countryside, the possibility of transformation and of just work every day is something they feel very grateful for.
Because, I mean, London is, as well, a city of immense possibility. I mean, possibilities financially, possibilities in terms of economically, but also personal development.
I think we miss it, or are a bit embarrassed to talk about it, because we're British. But London, the new London, is a city of amazing eros. And coming could be from Bulgaria, it could be from Morocco, or from Ghana. But to be in a city where you really can love whoever you want, that's a thrill that really marks millions of people's lives. The fiddler takes me into the underpass. The encampment from Slobozia is under Hyde Park Corner. The shishi stucco and glistening Maseratis are out of sight. We enter subterranean tunnels of cream-white tiles. They shine with clinical white lights embedded into the ceiling. These are long and low tunnels, and they are covered with thin line drawings of the glories of Victorian London. Walls of men in top hats and ladies in flowing frocks, tiles painted with cavalry charges and country houses. And in places, if you look closely, they are smeared with blood and shit. Those English, they scare me. The fiddler points. This is where the smackheads are. They are mostly northern and they are dying. There is a girl with a blue sleeping bag who sits under the tiles of the golden coach and horses. She barely looks human, and she hides this in a thick waterproof hood because her neck has pinched and vanished, and her eyes have swelled up, all glassy and black, on a bulbous head which has lost its hair. So she looks more like an Anunnaki or an alien. Fiddler says she hardly sleeps. All of us from Slobozia are frightened of her. He says they always choose the tunnel furthest away from her, with the pastel-coloured sketches of the garden wing of Buckingham Palace, where they camp down, ripping up and laying down their scavenged cardboard boxes. Here we are. This is where we sleep. The rubbish of London.
Here we are in the underpass. What's it like coming back?
Every morning when the beggars gather themselves up to go out into the city, they stand in a little circle here or wherever they've been chased to that night, and they pray. And one of the things that really surprised me about the new London is what a spiritual place it is, how important faith is to people. It's hard to see it at first, but this is a city throbbing with the prayers from basement African churches and mosques in old scrapyards, a city full of Islamic angels and Ghanaian faith healers and Roma pastors pacing through these tunnels at night. And it's a city where prayer is a huge part of people's struggle against where they find themselves. In this tunnel, the people who were sleeping here would go, "We're the people they don't see. We're the people they don't want to see." When I was here and I slept here with them, I saw that, what it's like to really become invisible, for a whole village of homeless beggars to just vanish in front of people's eyes. And I think that reportage can help you see people, and it can help you hear people. And that's why I think it's important. I found often with people in this sort of hard-up London that they were very unused to telling the whole arc of their lives. And it was a very magical, sometimes very strange experience to see people realise where they'd were or how far they'd come or what had got wrong. Often in these conversations, you just see things just click in people's heads. People would sometimes leave me devastated or elated by what they'd realised when they were really talking to themselves. I remember one long conversation I had with a woman in which I just watched in her eyes as she realised she didn't love her husband. One time when, just by asking questions, I saw a man just completely light up with how far he'd escaped this terrible, oppressive situation he'd been in Ghana. And he went back to cleaning the underground with a picking stick, a conqueror.
And when you heard these amazing stories, did you then try and dig into their backgrounds a little, or were you just taking what they're saying at face value?
I spent a lot of time with them. You want to be as much as you can this sort of sounding board for the theatre of their minds and their pains and joys. The two pickers are Big Yor and Baby Yor. Big Yor is very uneducated. He can barely even read. He hates everything about London. But to anyone who will give him 2 minutes, he will show the same grainy phone clip of the concrete walls of the unfinished Ghanaian dream home. London, it's a mistake. I'm stuck picking down here till I die. Big Yor and Baby Yor spent all day finding things they could never afford. They will be picking a tunnel and then a new iPad. They will be picking a train and out of nowhere, a wide-angle lens camera. But they know better than anyone else, everything in the underground flickers on CCTV. This is why they are always too scared to touch whatever they find, beyond quickly handing it over to the station master.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stand behind the yellow line.
You know, listening to these stories, I found that when people are young, when people have just arrived, and you know, a cleaner is never a cleaner, a picker is never a picker, they're always going to become someone else. The picker is on his way to becoming a businessman. The cleaner is always on her way to becoming a nurse. People don't see where they are as where they're going to end up. You know, that's what they're doing now, but their eyes are always fixed on what they view as the moment when they'll have made it. Before you've committed a few crimes, you have no idea how easy they are. You don't know that if you punch someone and swoop for his phone, the chance of them catching you is next to nothing. I swore to myself, I'm going to do this for 1 year. I'm going to roll with Lucifer and get money. Biggest mistake I ever made. Turned me into a demon because I was rolling with a low-down motherfucker. Heartless monster, I tell you. He's the kind of brother who'd sell you his little sister's pussy for a tenner. Moses knew the real gangsters aren't on the street, of course. The real gangsters never look like they do in the rap videos. They keep as low profile as they can, or they've already gone legit, creating them property empires out of thin air. But at that time, I didn't realise that. I was psyched. I was rolling someone I thought was hard. I was making £1,000 a night in money houses. I was making like 500 a week on them phones. I was getting a name, becoming a bad boy. And you know what? Bitches, they always get wet for violence. Lucifer was a good teacher. There was bear rich territory next to White City. You only have to cross the motorway, the one always droning, and bam, there was Holland Park. Those were their money houses, those big white pimp villas.
Here on Shepherd's Bush Green, according to your cocaine dealer, Moses, the bankers and the lawyers coming out of the money houses are all playing the same game as the gangsters selling them white. After all, behind every rich family in London is a drug dealer and a history exploiting sugar, slaves and opium. So are the comfortable classes who read your book, they're responsible for the misery you describe?
I'd just like to specify that he's not my cocaine dealer. He's a sort of gentleman going about his business in the area. On a level, I think he's right. One of the shocking things about modern London is that, you know, every night there will be hundreds of parties in stucco mansions, people having a good time, people feeling successful, going to make a few calls. Someone will turn up with pouches at the door, sell them, hand them over. I asked Moses, how do you feel when you turn up, hand stuff over at the door? And he told me one of the emotions he felt was hate. Flushing through his mind was the knowledge that these fortunes of Chelsea, Kensington, were built on the legacy of the British Empire, on sugar, opium, slavery, And why was he the criminal? Why were those people not criminals? And I don't know how many people at the party had ever wondered what was flashing through his head. I think that in Britain today, we don't like preachers, don't like sermons. I think we really did in the 16th, 17th century, but now people react badly to that, maybe because of the sort of propagandistic atmosphere about politics in the press. And what we're really trying to do with this book is to show people that picture of London. You may not like it, you may be shocked that people are racist, that people are sexist, you may be shocked about a lot of the violence and the poverty going on there, but I want people just to look at it and to see what the city really is. I don't think you can even begin to have a real conversation unless people are looking at this really new, really strange place straight up.
That was Richard Lee speaking with Ben Judah on location around London. This Is London is published by Picador.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/Guardian.
Sunjeev Sahota is one of the success stories of multiracial 21st century Britain. The grandson of a family which emigrated from the Punjab in 1966, he studied maths at Imperial College in London and says he didn't even pick up a novel till he was 18. And yet, his first book won him a place on the once-in-a-decade Granta Best of Young British Novelists list. And his second, The Year of the Runaways, went one better by being shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It's a brave and original novel which faces down that hot issue, illegal immigration. Two of its four protagonists have married to secure visas. A third is a refugee from India who arrived in the back of a lorry fleeing Hindu nationalist violence. And the fourth is on a student visa, though he has long given up studying. The novel shows where they've come from and how their paths intersect and diverge. It begins with a reading as Tochi, an untouchable, takes his first steps towards escaping India for the UK.
Shivroop Sky Travel, a small glass-fronted building with a life-size cutout of an air stewardess in the doorway. Dodgy pushed inside, into the freeze of the air conditioning. A dark woman, a perfect strip of vermilion in her parting, looked up from behind her desk. She asked if she could help. She didn't smile. "I'm here to see Mr. Tipu Reddy." "What is it in connection with?" "I'm here to see him about flights abroad." She sighed, seeming to understand, and leaned heavily to one side, perhaps pressing a button. Several minutes passed before a man stepped through the curtain at the back of the office. He was short, even darker than the woman, and with a jumped-up little moustache whose tips pointed to God. The woman said something in Tamil, and then the man clicked his fingers and told Dodgy to come upstairs. An hour later, and Dodgy was back on the street, his money satchel lighter. 2 weeks, the man had said. He'd called someone in Delhi and said that Dodgy could be on a flight to Turkey in exactly 2 weeks. After that, he'd be trucked as far as Paris, which was in France, and from there Dodgy would be on his own. Did he understand? "Yes," Dodgy said. "Of course, I'll come with you as far as Delhi, as part of the service." And then Mr. Tipu Reddy took out some forms from his little Tamil drawer and snatched up the pen leaking in his shirt pocket. There was a map on the wall behind him. "Where is France on there?" Dodgy asked. Mr. Tipu Reddy twisted round. "Oh, no. France is in Europe. That is South India. I am from..." He reached back and jabbed his pen into the map. "There. Kanyakumari, the southernmost tip of India. The end of the country." Dodgy nodded. "It is the only point in the world where three oceans meet, so you see it was in my blood to help people straddle the seas." He gave a little laugh. It sounded like something he said often. Anyway, I expect you will be wanting to make payment.
So that is an introduction to Dodgy, who is one of four characters in this novel, who is about to embark on his journey into Europe. It's a very familiar story. It's the story that's been hogging the news headlines all year.
Yeah, it's a story that's, I think, been hogging the headlines my whole life, really. It doesn't feel new. And even just before me, immigration has just been part of my family history, you know, as well as my personal history. So it felt quite natural that I would one day write about the topic.
But you were born in England. You were born in Derby.
I was born in Derby. My parents were both born in India, and my paternal grandparents. Firstly, they were living in the part of India that's now in Pakistan. So after partition, they migrated across the border and lived a slightly nomadic life, searching for land that they could farm. And then, in the early 60s, my grandparents and my father and his siblings made the trip over to the UK. And then my mum came over in the late 70s, and then I was born a couple of years later here.
So they were legal immigrants, and what you're dealing with here is illegal immigrants.
They were, So in the early 60s, you could come over legally. Then my grandfather came over on a sort of, there was a voucher system. There was a need for manual labour in the north of England, and he came over and worked in Derby in an iron foundry. But even around that sort of, even though he was legal, there were still people. In the sort of the mid-60s, the laws changed and it became much more difficult for people to come over, or at least come over and bring their families over and settle. So from that point onwards, I think people coming over by slightly more dubious means became more and more prevalent. And I think certainly while I've been interested in or aware of the topic, you know, the issue over the last 15 or so years, every time I go to India, and I go maybe once, sometimes twice a year, you know, it's not difficult to come across young men and women, and most of young men who are just quite desperate to come to the West, whether it be that the UK or Canada or America or Australia or New Zealand. So it does feel like over the last 15 to 20 years, people want to take their own part in this sort of this global wealth.
Getting back to the novel, I mentioned that there are four characters, and they end up in Sheffield, where you now live, in a flat. It's a sort of flop house, really, isn't it? Or three of the characters end up there.
Yeah, absolutely. So they live... So they do all come together. They're all from... Three of them are from India, and one of the characters, Narinda, she's from Croydon. And they end up in Sheffield, and Narinda lives in Brightside, which is sort of to the... just north of the city centre, sort of David Blunkett's old constituency. The three men, they live in just off Ecclesall Road, which is a road I know, south of the city centre. So there's sort of the city divides the men from this single woman. It's a city I know really well. I was brought up just south of the city in a small town called Chesterfield, and Sheffield was sort of the city I'd always escaped to, and Ecclesall Road in particular.
You describe Narinda as a single woman. That's not strictly accurate, is it? Technically.
A single in the sense of the single female protagonist in the book. But no, she is teed up to get married by her father and her brother. Her mother died when she was 9 years old. And part of the reason why she does run away to Sheffield, and it is only part of the reason, is to sort of buy some time, I think. Suppose she feels she has to go along with this arranged marriage.
And she is actually married to Randeep, who's one of the characters, who comes across on a false marriage licence. I mean, that's one of the ruses that they use.
Yeah, so Randeep, out of the three characters, he's probably the one that's most privileged. He's the son of a government official in India, which he's quite fond of telling people. You know, my father works in government, so he can probably afford a marriage visa, which is probably the most expensive type of visa to acquire by those sort of illegal means in India. And yeah, so he and Narinda goes across to India, marries him. She comes back to England. She sort of goes to the authority, says, I fell in love. I married this guy. You know, you must now let him come and live with me in England. So that enables Randeep to come over, though they don't really live together properly as man and wife. And that's one of the difficulties they face, is trying to give the appearance of being a bona fide couple when they're not. And then there's the other two characters, Avdar, who comes over on a student visa, though he has no intention of ever going to the College of Northwest London, I think he is. And then there's Dodgy, who comes over with no visa at all and just makes his way over by truck through various countries.
And you paint a pretty grim picture of what their lives are like. It involves sewers, washing up in horrible, dirty kitchens, all sorts of things, and not getting, you know, really being exploited.
Yeah, and largely exploited by the first wave of migrants to the UK, sort of Indians who came over in the 60s or 70s and have now become naturalised citizens. And I think it's interesting. I don't think those people that are doing the exploiting see themselves as being exploitative. They almost see it as a rite of passage. This is what they went through when they came over. They had to do these jobs and earn a low pay and gradually work their way up. So I think they just think it's just passing tonnages, that they see themselves as helping the boys. They're giving them work, they're giving them a roof over their heads in many instances. But you're right, from the boys' perspective, they're earning very little pay, they're living in cramped and difficult conditions, which creates these sort of tensions in the house as well. And a lot of that's because they bring over all this baggage or the hierarchies from India to do with caste and status and position, and those don't go just because you cross the border. They're still very much, unfortunately, still very much alive in the house and in the wider British Sikh community as well.
So it's particularly a Sikh community. One of the interesting things about this novel is there is only really one white character who features in it, isn't there? All the rest are this Asian diaspora.
Yeah, and the white characters in it are all quite minor as well. And that I only realised that sort of partway through the novel, but I thought that felt quite natural and quite true to the laws of the book, that, you know, these young men, as far as I can work out, they don't want anything to do with anyone that they can't. They don't feel they can immediately trust, so in their eyes, they'll stick to what they see as their own and the people that they think will, even if they will exploit them, at least they won't shop them.
Your own background, we said you grew up in Chesterfield, born in Derby. You're a mathematician. You say you didn't read a novel till you were 18. Can that be true?
Yeah, it can be true. It is true. There were certainly words were always around, and I read at school lots of plays and poetries and Shakespeare. But for some reason, in my particular set, in my particular year, the novel didn't somehow appear. I think there were extracts of novels in anthologies, but that's as far as it went. So, yeah, I was 18 when I read. Looking back, it's very easy to say that was a turning point and I can rationalise it. But I think at the time, it didn't feel like a particularly new thing. It just felt like, you know, this is just something that... I didn't think that I was stepping into something different.
And the novel you read was?
That was Midnight's Children by... Well, everyone knows who it's by, yeah.
And then you went on to read other Asian literature, particularly like A Suitable Boy things.
Yeah, I was on my way to India, just about to board the plane. And I think perhaps because I was in India after I'd read Midnight's Children, I wanted to read more. When I caught the bus into the city, you know, the books in the bookshop, the one bookshop I think that was I could find in the city, mainly had Indian authors. So A Suitable Boy, Fine Balance, Took a Lot of Small Things, so those sorts of books.
And you went to study math. You didn't do a creative writing or even an English degree.
No, by that point I'd already been accepted by university to study math. So yeah, I did maths for 4 years. And that's probably during my university time that I did most of my reading, when I perhaps should have been concentrating on my degree. I did spend a lot of time reading 2-3 novels a week on occasion.
And you went on to work for an insurance company?
I worked for an insurance company for several years.
Were you writing all this time while you were working?
No, I started writing. I was just reading. I didn't start my first book until the summer of 2006. It was writing in the evenings and the weekends. And it wasn't until 2013, when I was about halfway through the first draft of my second novel, this book, that I started writing full time.
And you made your debut with Hours of the Streets in 2011, and it was an instant hit, wasn't it? I mean, it's a very newsworthy subject. It's a young man deciding whether he's going to be a suicide bomber.
Yeah, I can see that it might look like I sort of pluck things out of the headlines, but that's not how it feels to me. It almost just feels coincidental that these are the things that are currently considered newsworthy. For me, both the books start from, you know, their springboards are quite, you know, inside me and quite personal. The first book, Hours of the Streets, I was living, you know, perhaps just a mile away from Muhammad Siddiqui Khan, who got called the ringleader for the London bombings, and, you know, just questions that, like, how could a young man who was, in some respects, you know, exactly like me, brought up in the north of England, the son of immigrants, you know, how could he go down such a different path? And the second book, just immigration, has just always been in my life and in my family's life, so it felt quite normal that I might want to just tap into that frequency and see if there was a novel there. So now I can see they do appear newsworthy. I think that's not how they first reveal themselves to me, at least. I think my next novel, I'm going to have to make it something totally...
You have to write about sort of people, white people living in the south of England or something. The structure of this novel really interests me because it is absolutely not a creative writing school novel, is it? You've got very short sections for when they're in Sheffield in the UK, and then you have almost like novellas of backstories of how they came to be in the country.
That was really important important to me. Just I wrote those chapters first, those novella-y type backstory, just so I could understand who these characters were and how they got to the point at which we see them in that first chapter, how they got to be in Sheffield. And me, it's just about, from a technical point of view, it gives the novel a completeness. Because, you know, you see these characters in Sheffield and you might have one idea or view of them, and then you see slowly you reveal how they got to that point. And then once you know how they all got to the point, then the sort of, hopefully the narrative engine kicks in and it takes you through to the end. And also just from a characterological point of view, I think just to see them in the round was important rather than just seeing them in Sheffield. I think actually, you know, if just from understanding them and the different kinds of people that might want to come here, you know, the different kind of things they might have gone through, the fact that, you know, we can't put one label on all of these young men. And just from my own point, just to keep it interesting, just to keep them all different and keep them all, just gave rise to different tensions and different ways of hopefully keeping the reader engaged.
You've already been on the Granta Young Best of Young British Writers after your first novel. What does it feel like to be feted by the Booker?
It felt great. I mean, the Granta nod was amazing. Probably, apart from reviews, it was the first sort of impartial sort of verdict on me and as a writer, and I'll be just eternally grateful to Granta for that. And it gave me just a great fillip to a writer's confidence, a new writer starting out. And the Booker nod was, I mean, when I got the call about the long list, it was a deep shock and just quite an emotional shock and wonderful. It's a list that, you know, it's the prize that I've probably followed most, and it's sort of formed my reading and what I should be reading, especially in my 20s, it did. And so to be on the list and in the company that it's in, it's just, yeah, it's, you know, I'm over the moon, as is, I think, my whole family here.
Sanjeev Sahota's The Year of the Runaways is just out in paperback from Picador. Thanks to both him and to Ben Judah. Next week, we'll be heading across the channel to the refugee camp just outside Calais, which is known as the Jungle, where we'll investigate how literature supports and inspires those in the most desperate straits. You can find us online or install us on your smartphone by searching for Guardian Books Podcast. Until then, from me, Claire Armitstead, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.